Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Notes from the Isle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Haunted Opera House. My name is Alfred Hitchcock. No, not really. I'm Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about the arts events at the Opera House and around the region, as well as interviews with artists and creators across the county. With the cancellation of the George Winston concert, it's become a bit of a slow 2 weeks at the Opera House, but that doesn't mean it's a slow 2 weeks for the arts in northern Chautauqua County. There's concerts, artworks, and theater galore to go out and experience, and in this episode, we'll listen to 3 interviews from the music, art, and theater world. But before we do, just a reminder that if you still haven't gotten around to asking for your refund for your George Winston tickets, you still have time to do so. Just call the 1891 Fredonia Opera House box office at 716-679-1891 to inquire about your refund choices, or email us at operahouse@fredopera.org. There's no better way to kick off the Halloween weekend than with a little bit of haunting Halloween music, and the Rockefeller Arts Center's Halloween Spooktacular Concert featuring the Western New York Chamber Orchestra should be just the thing. I caught up with the music director and conductor for Winnico, Maestro Glenn Cortese, to get a little background on what he's scared up for the concert. Maestro Glenn Cortese, thanks for coming in and taking in the time. We have the Spooktacular concert coming up from Winnico, the Western New York Chamber Orchestra. Can you give us a little background about how that got founded and your eventual involvement in it?
Yeah, the orchestra was founded, I guess it's getting close to 40 years ago now. I'm not sure of the exact amount of time, but I had faculty members at Fredonia that wanted an extra opportunity to play in another ensemble. And it went on from there, and they did a music director search back in 2005, and I've been there ever since. So this is my 16th season, I guess.
16th, that's pretty good. That's a long tenure.
What the ensemble is we're a professional ensemble, and we're in residence at Fredonia. So we interact with the School of Music. We provide opportunities for the school chorus from the music theater department, and definitely from the opera and voice department. So we collaborate with the School of Music. We also do some of our own concerts that are not directly involved with the School of Music, but we do perform there, and we perform also in Buffalo and throughout the Western Tier.
Oh, good. I'm sure people are going to enjoy catching you for this Spooktacular concert. You have quite a little bit of a program going on. It's very interesting. I think let's talk about a few of the pieces and so we can get the audience familiar with what they're going to hear. I think your first piece is going to be, or at least one of the pieces that you're doing is the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz. You want to give us a little preview of what that's about?
We're actually doing 2 movements from that. The Symphonie Fantastique was a kind of a very unique piece in its day. It was a symphonic work, but at the same time, kind of a tone poem. And there's a program note that Berlioz wrote. He imagined a young artist who poisons himself with opium, and through that goes through these different sort of dreams of what he has going on. One about this unrequited love. And the 2 that we'll be looking at are the March to the Scaffold. The hero sort of imagines himself as being led to the guillotine, and it's a very sort of a grand march that's often associated with Halloween and Halloween concerts because it's sort of macabre feel to it. And then there's a big fanfare at the end and a drum roll, and then you hear the blade fall and the head ba-boom into the basket. So it's very, very picturesque, but a wonderful symphonic representation of that dream that this artist is having. And then the final movement we're playing later in the concert, that is the which is sacrificial, raucous sort of dance. You know, imagines these witches down to fire night on the Sabbath, on their Sabbath. So it's again a picturesque and wonderfully audacious sort of look at Halloween through Berlioz's music and his imagination of this fictionary character who has these dreams.
Wow, that sounds kind of spooky.
Well, that's the point of the concert.
So. I think it's the point of the concert. Yeah, I was just going to say that's the point of the concert, right? Yeah, that's really good. Not quite as spooky, perhaps, but certainly something that has a lot to do with magic and magicians and all the kind of Halloween theme is Harry Potter, and you're doing the Harry Potter suite. I believe John Williams actually put that together. Is that correct?
Well, John Williams wrote the music for all the Harry Potter films, and this is an arrangement that Jerry Brubaker did of the main themes from the movie, so the original movie. So we're doing that, and we wanted to make sure that our young audiences have some really fun and wonderful stuff to be able to latch onto at the concert. So it's great music. John Williams is an amazing composer with everything that he's done, and it's really creative and imaginative, and it'll be a lot of fun for our younger audiences, but for grownups too, I think.
What do you see that's unique about John Williams? He's been on the scene for so long and has composed, you know, I mean, there's probably nobody on the planet anymore who doesn't have a John Williams theme stuck in their head from some kind of movie. How does he rank in terms of all of that?
Well, I think he's one of the greatest film composers ever. And I think that the thing about John Williams that's so interesting is he's able to really capture what's essential about the film in the music he writes. I mean, there's a lot of film composers, and a lot of them are good film composers, but sometimes the music is more just an accompaniment to the film. And I think with John Williams, in our imaginations, the themes that he creates and the way he interacts the music with the film, the music kind of becomes a character of its own in a lot of his films. And I think that's what makes him so special. The music becomes almost personified. And I mean, the greatest example of all is the music for Jaws, you know, that opening sequence where all that's going on visually is a helicopter that you don't see with the camera that's panned over the water, and they're flying over the water and you see this open ocean. But if it wasn't for that incredibly suspenseful music at the beginning, that would be just what it is, a shot of the ocean, you know, with no sound. And the way he gets us engaged right from the start in all of his movies is really very, very special.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with his. I've always been impressed with his ability to use individual themes for individual characters, and you know, even going back to Close Encounters, when he created that five-tone sequence, it was the same kind of suspenseful type of thing that just ran through the whole movie and really, really captured you through the whole thing.
Yeah, and in that way, he takes the best ideas of the great classical composers. You know, almost all of the great opera composers give us thematic ideas that go with characters in the opera, and John Williams does that with his characters oftentimes in the film. So it's a very special talent, and you know, he's made a place in film and also music history. He's also written concert music that's not related to film at all. That's wonderful music.
Yeah, he's something. 53 Academy Award nominations. I mean, he's something else. There's no doubt about it. And going to almost the complete other end of this spectrum, you've got Michael Jackson's Thriller, which is, I think, a very interesting choice. What made you choose that particular piece for this concert?
Well, it's the consummate pop tune for Halloween. It gets more airplay at Halloween than any other music does in the history of music since it first came out in the 80s. And I wanted to create something on this concert that really went the complete spectrum from classical music to film music to pop music. And I couldn't think of a better choice than this piece. It really did change how we think about recorded music video. That video was really a short film. It wasn't just a music video. And it upped the ante from that point on for anything that came after it in terms of the production level of music video. The stroke of brilliance of having Vincent Price's voice recorded at the end was incredible. Actually, Rodney Temperton wrote that song. Michael Jackson didn't write it. And he was a composer and producer of Motown and music from that genre, a really big talent. And the challenge for creating an arrangement for this that I did was we're working with a piece that almost all the sounds on it, including the drums and everything, were done with synthesizers. This was the 80s, and synthesizers were the new thing, and everybody was going in that direction. So to get that kind of sound into an orchestral palette is not an easy task, but it'll be a lot of fun. And again, something for everybody on this concert.
Yeah, that's an interesting piece. I remember when I first saw Thriller, and it was like, you know, you had to take every other music video you ever saw and like match it up against that one, because it was so right. It was so stunning, you know. Have you got anything specially planned for the orchestra in terms of the look, what the orchestra members will be wearing, perhaps, or anything?
We're encouraging the orchestra members to wear costumes, whether they all will or not, I don't know, but it will be either be that or some kind of black and orange for Halloween. And the audience is also encouraged to come in costume. And there will be some door prizes given out for best costume. Jefferson Westwood, who is really the producer of this concert, is working on those details now. So it should be a really fun event. And it's more than just a concert. It's really a Halloween happening, I would call it.
Oh, a Halloween. So is it okay if I bring my candy with me?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, that concert taking place in the King Concert Hall, I believe, on October 29th. Is it 7:30 p.m.?
It is 7:30 p.m. King Concert Hall, October 29th. And just in time for all the other festivities for Halloween to begin in Fredonia. So it'll sort of kick off the weekend.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a good way to kick off the weekend, I think, you know, with the opportunity to win door prizes and the whole thing will be spooktacular. Glenn, thanks for taking just a little bit of time, because I know you're a busy traveler and you travel all over the U.S. with orchestras and things like that. So thank you very much for your time. And I hope to see you again soon. I know you're probably going to be doing something in the spring, I believe. So we'll probably be able to talk then.
Absolutely. And one quick thing I wanted to mention was there are tickets for students for $5 for this concert, and they incorporate seats anywhere in the house. They're not just at the back of the house. So there's special pricing on all kinds of tickets. So I encourage people to go to the Rockefeller Arts Center website and check it out, because there's some really good deals.
Okay, great. Thanks. We'll make a note of that. Thanks a lot, Glenn. Good luck to you.
All right. Take care, Tom.
All right. Bye-bye. My thanks to Maestro Cortese for taking the time to talk with us. Once again, the spooktacular concert will be on Friday, October 29th at 7:30 p.m. in King Concert Hall. Tickets are available through the box office at 716-673-3501 or on the RAC website at www.fredonia.edu/RAC. There's quite a thrilling art exhibit on display at the Marion Art Gallery in the Rockefeller Art Center, and I invited the gallery's exhibition coordinator, Ms. Hyla Sue Stellhorn, to give us some details on the exhibit. Ms. Stellhorn, I should point out, is one of the region's most under-the-radar artists. She's an accomplished scene designer and properties master, having designed stage sets for the Department of Theater and Dance, the Hillman Opera Productions, and has served as properties master for the Chautauqua Theater Company. She shares her insights on the current exhibition in this interview. Hyla, welcome. Thanks for coming on the podcast. It's really, really fun to have you here.
Thank you.
So you are the coordinator, and basically what you do, you know, is you install the exhibits that come into the Marion Art Gallery, the Kathy and Jesse Marion Art Gallery. Tell us a little bit about the art gallery, where it's located, the kinds of things that it does, when it's open to the public. How can people enjoy it?
Well, the Marion Art Gallery is a product of a very generous endowment from the Marion family. And the purpose of it was to, even though we're a small community and an even smaller campus, that we would have the opportunity to showcase well-known works of art or more modern, successful artists that a town or a community this size like normally wouldn't be able to afford. So it was really generous of the Marians to fund this. And we typically do 4 professional art exhibits a year of well-known contemporary artists. It's free and open to the public. And at the end of each semester, senior art students who are A++, they get to present their work as so that they can say that they've had work presented in a professional gallery setting. The Marian Art Gallery is located on the first floor of the Rockefeller Art Center, and it's most easily accessed from Symphony Circle. Normally we have this giant red sculpture right outside the gallery, but there's a little construction going on right now. So if you find the construction fencing, you can find the art gallery. Our hours were closed on Mondays, but we're open Tuesday through Thursday from noon to 4, Fridays and Saturdays from noon to 6, and every Sunday we are open from noon to 4. The art gallery is a great place to socially distance, especially on Sundays. We don't really get a lot of foot traffic, so you typically can have the space to yourself to take time to wander and really enjoy the work.
Right. But I do think you have to remind people that even if they're the only ones in the art gallery, do they still have to wear a mask? Is that correct?
Yes. Anytime you're indoors, you have to wear a mask on campus.
That's a SUNY Fredonia regulation. So I just want to make sure that people understand that. Now, you are the technical coordinator. Is that your right title? Do I have your right title?
I'm the exhibition coordinator.
Exhibition coordinator. And what does the exhibition coordinator do? Do you personally get to design how the works are hung and how they look on the walls?
Well, I should say that I'm only part of the team. We have a full-time director named Barbara Raker. Mm-hmm. And Barbara has been doing this for 30 plus years, and she has an innate sense of what goes where. So we'll unpack all the work, set it up around the gallery, and then I just stand back and let her do her magic.
So tell me what you've got. What's the exhibit currently right now?
The exhibit right now is pretty dynamic. It's called John Buck, Prints and Sculptures. And John Buck is he's a woodworker. He's a master of woodcraft. He's a carver and a sculptor. And he also got into woodblock prints. I don't know if you're familiar with woodblock prints, but my experience had been, you know, someone will take a piece of wood or linoleum and then they draw a design on it, and then they'll carve that design out, and then whatever negative space will be white, and then the positive space that's left takes the ink or the color, and then it's pressed or rolled onto a piece of paper. And when you pull the paper off, then you have your woodblock print. Okay. But John Buck's work is like no woodblock print I've ever seen. The first thing that you notice coming into the gallery is that most of his pieces are between 5 feet and 6 feet tall. So they're just like this huge scale. And instead of being like one or two or three colors, he uses like really complicated color processes that result in like 12, 16, all the way up to 22 different colors on these prints.
So that's a heck of a, for something that tall and that many colors, that's gotta be a heck of a process.
Well, he doesn't do it alone. So he creates these prints, and he works with a master printer that runs out of Colorado, a company called Sharks Ink, and he'll mail them his wood blocks, often in several pieces because they're so large and so heavy. And then he'll give them kind of like a vague idea of what he has imagined for this piece. Right. So they will do a couple of different proofs called artist proofs. And so they'll try a few different techniques and colors, and then they'll send that to the artist, and then he'll give them the thumbs up or maybe some notes to try something a little different. They also go beyond printing. The process is so complicated for something of this scale that number one, they have to hand burnish everything. So they'll take hand tools, sometimes kind of like a dresser drawer knob or the bottom of spoons. And then by hand, they'll rub with even pressure over the whole piece of paper to make sure that the ink has even coverage. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that they do this, like normally you roll a big heavy wheel, like a press, you put the print through a press. But the John Buck's work is very detailed. So he uses a super soft wood from Southeast Asia called gelatong. And this wood is so soft that he can draw on it almost like a sketch pad. So he'll take like a nail or old ballpoint pens, or sometimes he'll even use his fingernail. And so it's almost like he uses these giant wood panels as like a sketch pad, or like it looks like someone has doodled on the outside of their notebook. So you have these very fine lines, like kind of like cartoon graffiti. And if you roll that through the press, because the lines are so fine, eventually that wood would flatten down and then the prints would lose their quality. So that's why it's such a process to do all of this by hand so that each print looks as good as the first one.
What is what about the thematic content of his prints? What is it? What does his artwork speak to?
There's a lot of content. So it depends on what you're into. When you see one of his prints, the first thing you notice when you walk in is there's a large primary image. So if you just walked into the art gallery right now, you would see like giant flames. You would see an eagle. There's like a cheetah. There's a glass jar with a potato growing out of it. One of my favorites is like a woman's torso that looks like a cage with a raven inside.
Oh my.
But then when you walk up to the piece, you know, so you'll see the raven, you know, in this woman's caged torso. But when you walk up to the piece and you start looking in the background, you'll see all these sketches and doodles that I was talking about. So they're the bird in the cage has a lot of issues about feminism and like ideals of women, stereotypes of women, but also accomplishments and roles that women can play. So when you start looking in the background, you'll see like a woman washing dishes, another woman frying up bacon and eggs. Then there's like a geisha hiding behind, coyly behind a fan. Mm-hmm. There's a Playboy bunny serving up a martini in a glass.
Oh my.
A nun with her hands together, head bowed in prayer. There's an image of Patty Hearst, we think is in there. There's a woman giving birth, a mother and child, like a mother nursing her child. So he's kind of, there's also like a stripper like popping out of a birthday cake.
Uh-huh.
So you see like all these different roles that women either play in society or are thought of as domestic or sex objects. But a lot of students who've come through the gallery said it really just, it doesn't show what people think of women. It also shows like how versatile women are and like how many things they can do in spite of those stereotypes. There's a lot of environmental issues too. He lives in Montana during the summertime on a working ranch, and he's very connected to nature. And then in the winters, he has another farm in Hawaii. So he's very connected to the earth, sustainability. So a lot of his work deals with pollution, capitalism, and what that's doing to our environment, and the animal population, and like how we need to learn to coexist. But he does it all in a way, maybe it's because some of his drawings are kind of cartoonish, but it seems like a little playful and lighthearted.
Yes.
So that even though the overall images might seem a little gloomy, there's hope.
That sounds really fascinating. I think people really, you know, ought to make an effort to get out and see that stuff, because that just sounds to me like incredibly fascinating. And I understand you also going to have the, like you said, the senior showcases. What sticks out in your mind when you think about senior showcases?
Well, it's really versatile. There are a lot of different majors within the visual art and new media program at Fredonia. So we typically have, you know, there will be painting students, drawing students. We usually have some animation and illustration and sculpture, ceramics. So you'll really get like a sampling of a little bit of everything that the students have learned or the programs that are offered at Fredonia as a whole. And I should also mention graphic design and photography.
Oh, yes.
They're part of this as well.
That's great. How long is the John Buck exhibit up until?
The John Buck exhibit is up till November 19th. Yes, it's a collection that's out on tour. And there's a man named Jordan Schnitzer who lives out on the West Coast. And he is in commercial real estate. So he's doing very well for himself. And so he's taken his wealth and he will find an artist that he thinks maybe is a little underrated or underrecognized. John Buck was one of his pet projects. Jordan Schnitzer offers his collection to a lot of universities or small galleries that couldn't normally afford to do a show of this value. So that's part of his philanthropy to spread art to like underserved communities.
So everybody has until November 19th to see this exhibit. And then the senior showcase after that for this semester will follow that, right? Am I right?
That's right.
I got that. Okay. All right, Hyla, thank you very much for the time, taking the time to come out and talk to me and let us know something about what's going on at the art gallery. Thank you, Hyla. Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Okay, bye-bye. My thanks to Hyla for sharing her wisdom and insights into the exhibition of John Buck's work. You can catch the exhibition now until November 19th, and admission to the Marion Art Gallery is free for all ages. Here's a reminder of a few upcoming events in the next 2 weeks. The Wild Party continues its run in the Marvel Theater for a second weekend, Thursday through Saturday, October 28th through 30th. The 1891 Fredonia Opera House Cinema Series kicks off its next collection of films on Saturday, November 6th, and again on Tuesday, November 9th at 7:30 p.m. with Falling for Figaro, the story of a brilliant young fund manager who goes off to fulfill her lifelong dream of becoming an opera singer. The Fredonia College Symphony will have its first concert on Saturday, October 30th, under the baton of Dr. David Rudge. And from November 1st through November 9th, you can catch a series of concerts in the Rausch Recital Hall featuring percussion, bassoon, clarinet, string, saxophone, and guitar ensembles, as well as the Fredonia Jazz Orchestra. See events.fredonia.edu/music. for more details. Usually when theater students graduate college, they go out and serve some apprentice time, learning their craft by gaining experience in out-of-the-way storefront theaters. My next guests, however, decided to forego their apprenticeships and started their own theater right here in Fredonia. Matthew B. Cullen and Julia Marie Black are the artistic and co-artistic directors, respectively, of Common Ground Theater Company, and will be presenting their first production, Everything Feels Like the End of the World, written by Ms. Black, on Friday and Saturday, November 5th and 6th. I found their energy so infectious and their insights so interesting that I couldn't decide what to edit, so I chose to present their whole interview. I think once you've listened to it, you'll realize why. I am so pleased to welcome to the podcast two young people who have begun their own theater production company right here in Fredonia. Matthew Cullen is a student at Fredonia in the Department of Theater and Dance, as is Julia Marie Black, although I believe, Julia, you've graduated. Is that correct?
Yes, I graduated in 2020.
Okay, so I just want to make sure that that's the case. And both of them are here with me to talk about Common Ground Theater. So I think the first thing I'm going to let you do is talk about Common Ground Theater. So Matthew, I think a lot of it is your idea. How did all this get started?
I've had the name Common Ground Theater Company in my head for about 5 years now. It was about a sophomore in high school when I said, I think this is something I want to do. I want to create a space where artists can all come together and create. Because at the end of the day, that's all we're trying to do, right? Is just create, just tell stories. And I just love working with people I love and smart people and my friends. And I said, hey, a company is a really great way to do that. And I found as I've grown over the last 5 years, things that I've noticed in the theater industry that I don't exactly love. There's especially through summer 2020 and the past 18 months, really, we've seen a lot of different aspects of our industry that have been highlighted that are incredibly unhealthy. And I view this company as a way to really start healing. It's a space of healing, not only for ourselves as artists, but hopefully for our industry to kind of promote new practices, healthier practices, and really just give artists a place where we can feel comfortable to tell a story.
And Julia, how'd you get involved? What drew you to the company?
So I became involved at the beginning of the pandemic, mainly because Matthew had reached out to me and said, hey, I want to, you know, do some play readings with some friends. You know, everyone's struggling right now. Everyone just lost their summer contracts or their year-long contracts. So let's get, you know, groups of people together. We'll read a play together and just have fun and try to forget about all of the craziness that's going on. But I need someone to help me cast things. And I was like, sure, I'd love to be involved. And this was essentially a support group for actors, basically blossomed into what is now the Disruptive Compassion branch of Common Ground Theater Company.
Can you talk a little bit about that, the Disruptive Compassion branch? A little bit more, give us a little more detail on that.
Absolutely. So it is currently run by the incredible Kate Fitzpatrick, and she is an incredible theater artist, director, teacher, lovely human being. And the whole goal of Disruptive Compassion, now that the theater is fully formed, is to introduce young playwrights to the scene and give people an opportunity to try roles they've never been able to try before in this capacity, all over Zoom. So, you know, we can have actors from Chicago and California coming to the same read and getting to know each other. And it's a really great opportunity for not only for young artists to encounter new work, meet new people, network, but also have discussions. You know, how can I take this thing that I've just read and implement everything I've learned to become a better person and a better, you know, civilian in society?
So much of theater is based on kind of what happens after, I think, or I think that's what we are, a theater model should be. You know, we all go and we tell the story, when you have the artists come, the audience come in and experience it, and we have this wonderful 2 hours or so of community right there. But what happens after, I think, is just really what our art form, I want to target with our art form, is how can what we do make a difference after folks leave the theater. And the beautiful thing about Disruptive Compassion, like Julia had said, it was just the conversations, the discussions, and kind of the again, we did this all of summer 2020. We've had some conversations that went on for 2 hours after the read, and maybe it was only a 90-minute read. People want to talk about what they saw. They want to, don't want to leave it just yet. And I think one of the awesome things that we do in Disruptive Compassion is calls to action at the end of each discussion, which is essentially, hey, we read the play and we got to talk about it. Now, how can we continue to advance it, and what ideas or practices did this play give us that we can apply to our everyday lives? Whether it's something like, you know what, I'm going to call my grandma today, or I'm going to buy someone Tim Hortons and that's Tim Hortons tomorrow, something like that. The little things and the big things that can really just make our lives happier and more full of grace.
Wow. That's a very impressive statement from a young man. So you're taking all of this energy that you have, both of you are projecting in a tremendous amount of energy, and you're taking it and you're putting it in this theater company, and you're kind of basing it right at the moment, at least in Fredonia. And Julia, you've got a play that you've written that's going to be up for production. Can you talk a little bit about that play that you wrote?
Absolutely. I would love to. So I, you know, went to school mainly to be in musical theater, and then the pandemic hit and I was put on the path of writing, kicking and screaming a little bit because I was like, no, I'm an actor. That's all I am. But then this lovely gentleman, Matthew B. Cullen, said, hey, I just took a class with this incredible director, playwright, actor. You should go, because I think you would really benefit from this. And so I started working with this playwright, actor, director, Ashley Griffin, and I started studying privately with her. And since that has happened, I wrote a libretto, the play, and a short film. And there is more to come after those projects. But Everything Feels Like the End of the World is a two-hander that I started writing back in October. But the idea has been in infancy in my brain since high school. Because I just, you know, was thinking, and the song Cheek to Cheek, performed by the illustrious Ella Fitzgerald, came on the radio one day. And I was like, oh, how funny would it be if, you know, an angel and a demon were dancing to this song together? And then that snowballed into what is now Everything Feels Like the End of the World, which is basically a story that follows an angel and a demon as they fight over the soul of a human.
And Matthew, you're the director, I understand. Is that correct?
Yes, that is totally correct.
What makes the play so interesting to you as a director? What I find sometimes directors will see things in plays that playwrights won't. And perhaps you've got an insight in there that maybe you could share with us that you've picked out that you find really fascinating as you've directed the show.
I'm a real big sucker for magical realism. Realism is great and all, but with the second you add in a little bit of magic, there's just something about that that for me, just like, I just want to be a part of it, you know? And Julia has a play about an angel and a demon who come to Earth. That's magic in itself. The awesome thing about the play is they seem so human the whole time, though. You kind of, at times, at least I forget, oh yeah, this is an angel and a demon. They're sure they're talking about their experiences, but they're human first and foremost. And they're really flawed, both of them, whether it's their current life experiences or when they were, before they died, life experiences, and how all of that kind of informs who they are as a person. And when we meet them in the show, you see the love that they have, you see the hope that they have, but you also see the love that they don't have and the hope that they don't have. And I think I love that contrast. I love watching a character learn to love, learn to hope, because while they're doing that, so are we as an audience, you know? So are we, as a director, I'm learning, oh yeah, this is what it's like. And there's new things that Julia is playing Angie in the show, who is the angel. And we have another wonderful Fredonia alumni named Jack Levenberg playing Devin, also class of 2020, and getting to work with them and watch them continue to explore and discover new things. It just reminds me how wonderful all the little things in life are. I think that's what I love about this play.
This is probably not a fair question. I'm going to ask it anyway.
Shoot it.
You are attempting to, create a new theater, a new theater organization in a time where the demographics tell us that theater is not exactly one of the most popular art forms in Western culture today. What do you see going into the future to try and get more people to recognize how theater can be as powerful as it is, and particularly people who are out of the normal range of demographics? I mean, we can talk about young people, we can talk about disadvantaged people, we can talk about, you know, all kinds of different people, but do you think you can do some things or have some ideas about how you can target your work to get people into the theater who ordinarily would never walk into one?
You're right. That's a loaded question. But I mean, I think it's exactly why I want to start it. I started a company. A little side tangent, but I think it really informs just who I am as an artist right now. I remember I sat around with a whole bunch of friends and we read The Laramie Project, a table read setting, right? And at the end of the read, everyone was just silent. If you're not familiar with Laramie Project, it's the story of Matthew Shepard, who was killed in Laramie, Wyoming for being gay. And this is a piece of fiction, nonfiction rather. So it happened, and just the silence and the anger and the frustration on everyone's faces at the end of this play was heard. I can come up with is informative, because I just, and as the conversation began, we just really got to see how all of these wonderful young artists are just wanted to tell these stories, but we recognize the people who are going to come see Laramie Project are the ones who already know the message, right? Laramie Project needs to be presented to smaller towns, like small towns. You know, we need to put that show in those communities so they can receive them. The problem is companies don't do that. Companies are based in really big cities, such as like New York, Chicago, Atlanta, LA, and even touring houses. You know, it's like Buffalo, Rochester, all Syracuse, all these big cities that, of course, they need these stories, but it's not this small town thing. It's not folks in smaller towns who don't have access to it. So kind of bringing this all together, sorry, I tangent quite a lot. Julia knows about this. Bringing it all together, I think it's our responsibility as a company to make theater and stories accessible, because at the end of the day, what we're doing is we're telling a story. It's a really, really basic thing. I'm going to put air quotations around this. It's not hard. It's very hard, but the basic base level of it is, we're just telling a story. It's been going on since before we could even speak. We were telling stories through dance and gestures and things like that. What theater is just maybe an elevated platform is the best phrasing I have now, though it'll probably change as I grow. And I think it's our job as a company to just find a way to make it accessible. How do we do that? We bring theater to small towns. We've promote it. We put it in people's faces. We find a way to get it in schools. I think schools, like school time shows are so incredibly crucial because we got to get folks exposed to this young. Otherwise they're going to kind of ignore it or might not be aware of that. It's a totally viable way of not only expression, but it's a career. It's very, very possible to make a career in this field. And I think it's just a place of catharsis. That's the educational term that everyone always uses, right? Theaters for catharsis. But I think if you really dive into what catharsis means for you as an individual based on each show, you can't not want to come back to the theater.
You want to add anything to that, Julia?
Yeah, I think bouncing off of that, we're in a time now, especially after so much isolation, that people are desperate for experiences. They're desperate for things they can go to and talk about. And I remember just before the pandemic, I was in New Paltz, New York, and I saw this incredible production of White Rabbit, Red Rabbit, which is a fascinating show because I can't tell you very much about it or else it would ruin the experience completely. But basically the whole premise is an actor is given a script right before they go on to perform it. They have to cold read the whole thing and they are given a task to do. And the audience has to watch them figure out how to do that task. And it was the most stunning piece of theater I've ever seen. I got in completely by accident because a friend of friend had tickets. You know, after we went to the show, we went to this bar where if you went to the show, you get like 20% off of drinks, which is a brilliant idea. More theaters should do this. And so me and my friend walk in and I see another person who'd been in the audience and he had done something very crucial to the whole experience of it, which I can't talk about. And I went up to him and I said, "Listen, thank you for doing that thing." And he was like, I could not, I had to go do that thing. And it was, that moment just kind of rekindled the whole reason why I go to these things, the whole reason why I do theater in the first place. Because, you know, when you're in that room, you are getting a once in a lifetime experience. And it should always be the goal of any theater company, of any group, to be like, I want this specific moment to be important to this specific group of people. It is just for them. And, you know, then they can go tell everyone about it. And, you know, someone else might be like, oh, I want to go experience something like that. And it's this never ending circle. But unless you get the ball rolling, that's never going to happen unless we have these conversations and get people involved. The ball will never roll and people will never go see another production of White Rabbit, Red Rabbit. Go see it if you ever have the opportunity.
I'm so full of questions. I'm sorry. I'm probably making this interview longer than it has to be, but
no, that's fine. Hit us.
Okay. But that's okay. Julia, let me ask you first, when you first came to study theater and now you've graduated and you're sort of at the very beginning of your career, what do you think in that time period changed the most for you to get you to become this playwright, theater artist that you are now?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think honestly, you know, everything that happened with the pandemic was such a tragedy and it still is a tragedy. People are still dying in droves every day. But I think if that hadn't happened, at least for me when it did, I wouldn't be anywhere near where I am right now. I, you know, was supposed to have a contract in Minnesota for a year. And then after that, I was thinking I would go to Chicago. I never even considered like, oh, maybe I should do playwriting. Maybe that's something that would be a good path to follow. But I think a lot of what brought me to where I am versus where I was when I started, I think I viewed everything in a very black and white fashion. You know, you have to hit these specific benchmarks or you're not a success. And by the end of my time at Fredonia, by the beginning of the afterwards pandemic, you know, void that we're all in right now, it was a matter of saying to myself, you know, if I want to do something, I need to do it myself. And if I want to create something, I have to create it myself and I have to either meet the right people or, you know, pull from the people I already know, but making those connections to get where I need to go. Me and Matthew, you know, when we first went to school with each other, we barely interacted. But if it hadn't been for him reaching out to me, you know, in this time of social isolation, like I wouldn't have one of the, you know, greatest creative partnerships of my life. And similarly, I wouldn't be in the internship that I'm currently in. I wouldn't know my mentor. I wouldn't have met so many incredible artists since moving to Jersey City. So a lot of, I think what changed for me was figuring out, you know, okay, there's no prescribed path of artistry. You know, you can only choose, you know, this is an opportunity, I'm going to take it. And if there isn't an opportunity, I'm going to make my own.
Same question to you, I guess, Matthew. Fair is fair, right? From when you first came to Fredonia to now, what do you think so far has changed in terms of the way you first thought about a career and the way you think about your career once you graduate?
I think the easiest way for me to answer that is just to talk about what I've learned. And one of the biggest things I've learned since being at Fredonia is help is healthy. Help is a good thing, and it's important to do it because you're never going to succeed in anything, let alone this industry, when you try to do it by yourself. I came in as a freshman. I was like, okay, I got to do it all. I got to do it my way and by myself. And God, if I kept up with that, I probably wouldn't be where I am at all. I wouldn't be anywhere near where I am right now. Being at Fredonia has really taught me that it's given me, first off, such a wonderful group of people to get to work with from just so many wonderful people. And it's made it easy to ask for help. It's made it easy to say, hey, I want to work with you. I want to get creative. Let's delegate these responsibilities and let's collaborate. Let's synthesize what we're going to do here to create this other big thing. Because at the end of the day, I think what we do as theater artists isn't necessarily for ourselves. Everything, of course, we do it for ourselves in some capacity, but our art form is really about community. Theater is about community and finding understanding through common ground, hence the name of the company. And I think you can't do that by yourself. So that's kind of what Fredonia has given me and how I've really grown as a person. I think the artist and who you are as a person, who you are as an artist are incredibly aligned. So I think that's my answer for you.
Okay. Well, no, I think that's a tremendously thoughtful answer. This is going to be a very, very hard interview to edit down. Okay, so let's get to the nitty gritty. Matthew, give us all the information about the upcoming production, where it's going to be, where we can get tickets, do all of that stuff for us, will you?
Sure thing. So Everything Feels Like the End of the World is going to be in Fredonia, New York on November 5th and November 6th. November 5th, there is a show at 7:30 p.m. And November 6th, there is a show at both 2 p.m. as well as 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $13, and you can go to our website, commongroundtheatercompany.com, theater spelled with the T-R-E, and you can click our End of the World page to find tickets there.
Okay, great. And I can't let Julia go without giving her the opportunity to promote her podcast.
Yes, I am one half of the Playdate podcast. The other half is our mutual friend, Katie Fitzpatrick. We do a very similar thing to what Disruptive Compassion does. We read a play and then we talk about it and we, you know, do our dream cast, dream production. And we find that call to action and we figure out how we can take what we've learned and bring it into our lives. And every once in a while, we have special guests.
Oh, great. And where is that available again?
That is available wherever you get your podcast. I personally listen on Spotify, but it's available pretty much everywhere. And you can follow us at playdate.podcast on Instagram.
Okay, great.
Tom, really quick, can I just pop in and just mention all the team members that are associated with Everything Feels Like the End of the World?
You absolutely can.
Awesome. I just want to make sure they get the credit here because we have an absolutely phenomenal team, hands down all around. So involved with Everything Feels Like the End of the World is Julia Marie Black, of course, Jack Levenberg, myself, Jace Jacobs, Autumn Rosa, Carly Robinson, Stephanie Workman, Sullivan Harris, Allison Nolan, Chris Mayer, Donnie Woodard, and Becky Barsnai. That is just our production
Kanan
team.
Harris.
And Kanan Harris, yes, he wrote a beautiful, beautiful piano piece. It's just going to make folks cry. It's made me cry so much. And we also have an absolutely incredible facilitating team at Common Ground, which consists of both myself and Julia, Stephanie Workman, Caroline Shetler, Katie Fitzpatrick, Violet Stefania, Aja Pandey, Brenna Jackson, Molly Conklin, and Mitchell Pellissier. We couldn't do what we do without all of these folks and more.
Listen, you two, thank you very, very much for your time. I think this is one of the most, it could very well be one of the most exciting developments I've seen in Fredonia in the time that I've been here. So my congratulations to you. You have my best wishes for a tremendous success.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye. It was such a pleasure to talk to these two young theater artists, and I thank them for their time, dedication, and vision. You can support their work by purchasing a ticket and getting out to see Everything Feels Like the End of the World on Friday and Saturday, November 5th and 6th. More information is available at www.commongroundtheatercompany.com. And that's it for this pre-Halloween edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Mr. Glenn Cortese, Ms. Hyla Sue Stellhorn, Mr. Matthew B. Cullen, and Ms. Julia Marie Black for being on the podcast. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891. Visit the website at www.fredopera.org or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Notes from the Aisle Seat. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.